On the way out the door, another fine mess, Ollie. Yes, President Bush has made history once again. A pardon Bush granted only a few days ago has been rescinded. New information has come to light, says the White House. Information like the former developer convicted of mail fraud made a giant contribution to the Republican Party.
Why don't you watch where you're going?
Like a string of other offenses, the Bush legacy, pardons, WMD, Constitution, just kidding. Kind of a Laurel and Hardy affair on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 25th. It's Christmas Day. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Merry Christmas, Adora. Full coverage of the rescinded pardon coming up.
Right. The extraordinary rescinded pardon. Going to talk about that. We're also going to take a look at the economy. We're going to look at the joy your brain gets after giving a gift. There's joy in your brain, John.
For giving.
And holiday food all around the world. Those stories are coming up first, these headlines.
If you're at your destination right now, count your blessings. Some travelers will need a Christmas miracle to get to theirs. Travel crowds alone are more than enough to strain transport. Add in cross-country severe weather, and you end up with a lot of horror tales like this one.
We had everything confirmed through text messages, everything. Got to Reagan for my layover, proceeded to the gate, and our plane was downsized, and my row on the plane didn't exist anymore.
That's right. An existentialist Christmas for some travelers. Very appropriate, actually. From trouble in the sky to trouble in the seas, this time a win for the good guys. A German military chopper foiled a pirate attack off the coast of Somalia today. Pirates had fired on a cargo ship, hurting a crew member. There are now more than a dozen warships hunting pirates in the region. Hijackers have drawn some $30 million in ransom this year.
Interesting. Maybe a preview for 2009 and those pirates in East Africa. Christmas began in Bethlehem, of course. The town is still there, now part of the Palestinian West Bank. Christian pilgrims from all over the world are there today celebrating Mass. But in the other Palestinian area of Gaza, violence continues. Palestinian militants there have stepped up rocket attacks on Israel. The Israeli military warns they will pay a heavy price if the attacks continue. Israel's foreign minister is meeting with Egypt's prime minister about the situation today. And as we mentioned, President Bush is taking the extraordinary step of revoking a presidential pardon. The president pardoned a Brooklyn man earlier this week. He did jail time for fraud tied to a mortgage scheme. But after news came out that his father made large and recent donations to Republicans, well, the pardon went away. The White House believes this is the first time a presidential pardon has been revoked.
More history for that Bush administration. Most markets are closed today. That includes Wall Street, Europe, and most of Asia. Japanese traders did go to work today. The Nikkei index closed up about 1%. And today, for this Christmas, we're going back to your childhood, talking about your dreams, wishes, and Christmas under the tree desires.
One Christmas, my mom said, "Well, I got you something that's like a Nintendo." And when I opened up the present, it was a battery-operated kaleidoscope. And to this day, I think that is in no way like a Nintendo.
I would like a battery-operated
That's
kaleidoscope.
That's Leo, one of our producers here at The Takeaway.
Well, we want you to think back. Was there one dream you had as a child that ever came true under the tree? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Now Leo just wears battery-operated kaleidoscopes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Merry Christmas to all of you all around the world. And we are on in like 30 markets now. That's so
great. I know.
Great. That's so great.
It's
Merry
a
Christmas
wonderful
to all
Christmas
of you.
Here at The Takeaway.
We are your fabulous Christmas. So is the coffee brewing. Kids are all excited. You're making breakfast. I just have to say, how do you get pardons wrong? How do you do that? How does that happen?
It's an extraordinary story, truly.
That Charles Manson? That Pol Pot. How do you do that?
It's hard to understand.
It's driving me crazy. Anyway. Anyway, more about that in the newscast. But as the Obama administration takes hold in 2009, the real central question, of course, is what have they tried in moving the levers in the economy and what is actually going to work? Because they're moving a lot of levers. When are we going to see signs of progress? The Obama administration is certainly going to go from promise to reality in record time as it takes power next month. Here to talk about the economic events that we can look forward to is David Leonhardt, economics writer for The New York Times. He joins us from Washington, D.C. David, thanks so much for being a part of the show.
Absolutely. Good morning.
As we look ahead, when do you think the kind of promise of the stimulus package, of the financial bailout, of the auto industry bailout, of other sort of economic programs, when does the promise become a sense of accountability and reality, or is that even going to take place in the year 2009?
I think there are two answers to that question. I don't think we should expect the economy to feel good at any point in 2009. And I don't think the Obama administration should be held accountable if it doesn't feel good in 2009. This is a really serious recession, and it's going to take a long time to recover. On the other hand, I do think the administration should be held accountable pretty quickly for how they design the stimulus and how much confidence it inspires in terms of feeling like they're really on top of the financial crisis and not changing their plan every week. So I actually think, I mean, by March 1, I think we should be able to make some judgments about how good a job the Obama administration is doing. I don't think that means the economy is going to feel any better by March 1.
You know, these stimulus package, theoretics are pretty difficult. And looking back at the Great Depression, I don't think it was clear to anyone who financed rural electrification in the United States that it was going to have such a broad sort of cultural influence on, our way of life in the United States. Yet it was a great investment. I'm just wondering if it's even possible to look that far ahead on the stimulus package to choose those investments that are going to be really important in stimulating demand and those that may just end up being sort of white elephant anomalies.
Yeah, there's this real inherent tension in stimulus because you could dig holes and then fill them again, and as long as you did it really quickly, you could do a great job of stimulating the economy, but that wouldn't have any of the effects of rural electrification. On the other hand, you could come up with all these great projects, but if they don't get started really soon, they're not going to stimulate the economy. They're going to have long-term good without short-term good. And so you have to do this balancing act between you don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good, and you want to try to come up with things that absolutely can be done quickly, but on the other hand, that you have reason to think are also going to be able to do some long-term good. And the problem is that given the size of stimulus we're talking about here, you probably can't fill up the whole basket just with things that you can do quickly and will have really a lot of long-term good.
David, let's expand that notion of accountability to Congress and also the Treasury Department. When you put the three together, the executive, Barack Obama, the president, the Treasury, and Congress, how are we going to start being able to rate how they are doing? Is that March 1st date still good in your mind?
Absolutely. And who knows? It could be February 1st. I mean, they're talking about wanting to have a stimulus package really quickly. I think one good measure is infrastructure. We've heard Obama talk a lot about infrastructure. Everyone seems to agree that roads and bridges and schools and things like that will be a really important part of the stimulus package. And so this is talking about Obama and Congress, not so much Treasury. We can get to Treasury. And I think one thing that we're going to want to see is that this isn't simply doing things that politicians want done. That there is some kind of analysis of, is this road really going to reduce traffic, or is it just going to fill up with cars? Is this road really necessary, or is it something that is a pet project of a member of Congress or a member of the administration? Right now, we're so bad at those kinds of decisions, we don't really even try, that if Congress and the administration can make us even a little bit better, I think they'll deserve some credit for that. And if they can't, it will be really disappointing.
Barack Obama has gotten a lot of accolades, I think it's fair to say, for maintaining a certain level of continuity in the national security apparatus. And if you count Ben Bernanke, of course, he doesn't really have a choice in this. Bernanke's term is, fixed. But the Fed chairman is somebody who represents continuity with the Bush administration, yet his term is up in 2010. And I wonder if that argues even now for a change to match Barack Obama's vision, whatever it might be, for the economy, or is Bernanke likely to be kept on, and is there reason for continuity moving forward with the Federal Reserve?
This is going to be one of the big economic stories of late 2009, I think. Bernanke's term ends early in 2010, February. And so at some point in 2009, Obama and his advisors are going to have to decide whether to reappoint him. And there are really good arguments on both sides. The arguments to reappoint him is that he's done a lot of really good things, and he's been really thoughtful about a lot of this financial crisis rescue, and he's incredibly well has an incredibly good background for it. I mean, he is a scholar of the Depression and of Japan. He's been very creative with all this stuff. If by the end of 2009 things look like they're turning up, there'd be a really good argument for keeping him, both economically and politically, because if you replace him and then things turn down again, right, you own it. So that's one argument. The argument on the other side is Bernanke's also made some mistakes. At times he's been really slow to recognize how bad this was. And I think there's a partisan argument that some people will make to Obama. We have had Republican chairman of the Fed for two decades now.
Right.
That position brings a prestige that almost nothing else does. And so there's an argument that Obama should put a Democrat in there, and that Democrat in subtle ways will then be able to help his own agenda.
But it's a little scary to tamper with, because the markets love the fact that Greenspan was reappointed year after year, and that continuity really lulled the markets into a sense of complacency. Some say caused a lot of the problems that we're dealing with right now. They manipulate this politically at their peril, don't you think?
That's right. And, I mean, you captured the problem right there, which is they loved that he was appointed year after year. And on the other hand, in retrospect, there are some real questions about whether his tenure was anywhere near as good as we thought at the time. And I think Bernanke is considerably more pragmatic and is less tied to a philosophy than Greenspan was. Well, and so there are certainly arguments for reappointing him, again, if it's something that you think the market would like. I also have this sense that intellectually, Bernanke and Obama are probably going to get along quite well. I think they're going to think about things in somewhat similar ways. That doesn't mean they'll come to the same decision, and it doesn't mean Obama will reappoint him, but my guess would be that they're going to like each other.
If I had to bet, though, David, I would say he has to be reappointed because Bernanke has remade the Fed. The Fed has authorities now that it never had before. There are people who go to the discount window who never showed up there before. If only to manage this new extraordinary transition, you have to keep Bernanke.
Well, I think a lot of it will depend on how the economy feels in late 09. I mean, if it still feels really terrible, if it still feels like we're not out of the credit crunch, if it feels, if anything, like it's gotten worse, I'm not sure we'll feel that way then. We may feel like, wow, things are still really bad, and Obama politically wants to blame someone and wants to make a switch. And, you know, he's going to have sitting by his side in the White House Larry Summers as one of his top economic aides. Larry Summers would be an obvious candidate to be a Fed chairman under a Democrat. And so I agree with you. If things are turning up, it's going to be very difficult for him to pick someone else. And maybe he shouldn't, and maybe he won't want to. But if things are really bad in late 09, I'm not sure we'll still feel that way then.
All right. Well, finally, unemployment is not going to improve in 09. There's virtually no forecast that says. What do you think the peak will be?
It's hard to know. I mean, people are now talking about in the 9% range.
Wow.
We got above 10% back in the early 80s. The thing to keep in mind is 10% now, if we happen to get there, or even 9% now, is a lot worse than 9% was back then, because there are more people now who aren't working and aren't looking and so are not officially counted as unemployed. But the job market's going to get a lot worse in 2009.
Not pleasant, but something we definitely have to look forward to. David Leonhardt, New York Times writer and columnist, talking to us from Washington, D.C. David, thanks so much.
Thank you both.
Some sobering thoughts for this Christmas, which takes us back to our childhood, and we want to send you back to your childhood, thinking about dreams, wishes, and desires from Christmases of yore.
This is Todd Zwillick with Capital News Connection, Washington, D.C. Come around Hanukkah time, holiday time, what I really wanted was a red energy dome. If you don't know what that is, that's a hat. Some people think it looks like a flower pot. I really, really wanted one of those, and I'm not sure my mom even knew where to get one. Well, I didn't get one for Hanukkah that year, but I did manage to find the Devo fan club, Club Devo, and I got one for myself by the time I was about 13, and it's in my living room to this day. My dream was fulfilled.
Your energy dome, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Thanks,
go,
Todd.
Go, Todd Zwillick!
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Oh, the dreams of Christmas and the realities of what ends up under the Christmas tree.
Hey, Adora. Hey, John. This is Ethan calling from Germany. I just wanted to share the memory of an Erector set that I saw in the window of FAO Schwartz. It was probably the late 70s, and I coveted it, and I thought I was going to be getting it, but I didn't get it. And I've been pining for it ever since. No, I've gotten over it. Happy everything to everybody there. Merry Christmas.
Oh, is it scarred for life, cry for help, or Merry Christmas? I love it, though. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And, of course, it is the holidays, and we are talking about gifts. And there's going to be at least some gift giving, perhaps not as much as usual given the economic crisis. However, we're going to take a different look at gift giving. We're going to think about how do you feel when you give a gift and why do you feel so compelled to give a gift to someone who's given one to you. Takeaway contributor Jonah Lehrer has some thoughts on this. He's a neuroscience writer, author of the book Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and he joins us from Boston. So, Jonah, what's going on with my brain when I give a gift?
Well, you're actually experiencing a rush of dopamine. There's a well-done brain scanning experiment last year that showed it put people in a brain scanner and had them give money to charities they believed in, so causes that they thought were doing good. And to the surprise of everyone, the act of giving money away activated this rush of dopamine in the midbrain, which is typically associated with what happens when people get a reward. So when you eat a bite of chocolate cake or when you show a crack addict a picture of a crack pipe, you see these dopamine areas light up. But these same areas also light up when people are giving money away to these good causes.
Now, crack addiction and giving gifts, somehow they seem on different ends of the spectrum, but you say our brains are activated in the same way?
That's the funny thing about the brain. It's that same warm glow of pleasure, that same warm glow you get when a crack addict gets crack or when you eat something delicious or when you see the face of a loved one. This same brain area, the dopamine-rich areas in the midbrain light up. And I think to the surprise of the scientists, acts of altruism, so giving money away, not just getting, but giving money away, also activated these brain areas.
I'm surprised the Red Cross doesn't use that as a sort of a pitch. Give to the Red Cross. It's like crack. But I haven't really seen that much. And why doesn't it activate the dopamine centers of your brain when you're like handing money to the toll booth on the New York Thruway?
Well, it might not be a cause you believe in. I mean, the key trick here, and the reason paying taxes might not do the same thing, is obviously if you're a liberal, giving money to the Republican Party ain't going to activate your dopamine areas. It's giving money to a cause that you think is doing good. The surprising thing is we tend to think of ourselves as these Darwinian selfish brutes who are just out for our own self-interest.
And
yet this study shows that we are hardwired in a way to get pleasure from giving our money away.
So we're primed for reciprocity.
Yes, we're primed in a sense for altruism. And this makes sense in the grand scheme of things. We're also social primates, so we had to learn how to live in a group. And so giving money to the needy, if we think they deserve our help, makes us feel good.
But what evidence is there that this dopamine rush that we get when we give a gift of some kind, express this altruism, is a part of this evolution into a social being? Why do we think that helped us to survive socially?
Well, the fact that it seems to be built into the brain, that this is a fairly universal trait, that everyone seems to get pleasure from giving money away to a cause that they think is doing good, suggests that this is hardwired and is part of this larger social network, collection of social talents that we have. The catch, however, and it's worth mentioning, is that as you mentioned in the intro, the brain also demands reciprocity. So that when we give something away, if I give you a cashmere sweater and you give me in return a mechanical pencil, that'll activate a separate rush of social emotions and I'll get very angry. And there are a bunch of economic experiments that have really captured that emotion in action.
Let's go a little bit, let's take a look at that for a second. So it's also this good feeling that I get when I receive a gift or when I give a gift is also hardwired to a level of disappointment that triggers anger?
Yes, in a sense. So it feels good to give money away to a cause. On the other hand, if we give someone, as I said, a cashmere sweater and they give us a mechanical pencil, this will trigger a very angry emotion. This is probably best captured in an economic game called the ultimatum game, which is a very simple game. You give one person $10 and you tell that person, you can divide this $10 between you and your friend any way you want. The only catch is if your friend rejects your offer, then nobody gets anything. So you're all worse off. Now, if we were rational creatures, as economics expects, you'd expect the person to divide the $10, so they keep $9 and give the other person $1. It's a very unfair division, but the other person should reject their offer because $1 is still better than nothing. So everyone leaves with something. It's unfair, but that's the way the world works. However, this isn't what happens. When you give someone $10, they tend to divide it 3, 4, 5, so they end up making pretty fair offers to the other person. And the reason why is because they know that if they make an unfair offer, the other person will get angry and punish them, and so no one will get anything. So this shows, I think, is now taken to scene as a justification for why people seem to have this fairness instinct, that even though it feels good to give, we still demand fair offers. So we expect if we give someone a good gift that we shouldn't get a mechanical pencil.
Once again, Joan Allaire explaining to us how complicated the brain really is. Joan Allaire is a neuroscience writer, a Takeaway Science contributor and author of the book Proust Was a Neuroscientist. Have a good holiday, Jonah. And now we're going to get some headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. Now, as Christians around the world celebrate the holiday, there's a lot going on where Christmas has its origin. Small Palestinian rocket and mortar attacks have hit Israel in recent days, and observers expect a heavy Israeli military response soon. Israel's foreign minister is meeting with Egypt's prime minister about the situation today. Most markets are closed. That includes Wall Street, Europe and most of Asia. Japanese traders did go to work and the Nikkei index closed up about 1%. Some Americans working in Asia are recovering from a holiday scare. The US embassy in South Korea got a package filled with white powder. An early test showed that the powder doesn't appear to be dangerous. Several American embassies in Europe got similar letters this week. America's current and future presidents celebrate the holiday on opposite parts of the country. President Bush is with his family for their final Christmas at Camp David, and President-elect Obama and his family are in Hawaii. Both have roast turkey on the menu. In a recorded holiday message, the president-elect evoked another American leader in a much colder place.
George Washington and his army faced impossible odds as they struggled to free themselves from the grip of an empire. It was Christmas Day, December 25th, 1776, that they fought through ice and cold to make an improbable crossing of the Delaware River.
And NBA teams are playing today, and among the games, the LA Lakers take on the Boston Celtics. And if the Celtics win, it will be their 20th victory in a row.
They are the hottest.
Happy Christmas.
The hottest, yes.
Wow.
It's a record, actually.
It will be.
It's a record, yeah.
If they win.
They're already in the record for the Celtics
made
now.
It. Oh, it's okay. A record.
Yeah.
19 wins is a record.
Very good.
Thanks,
Femi. Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Merry Christmas. And, you know, we were talking here in the studio about the Boston Celtics record start, which is, you know, they're going for 20 and zip, and that's not a record for consecutive wins, but it is a record for a start. And it caused me to think, you know, I wonder if Obama has a favorite basketball team.
I mean, he must love
the Bulls because he was a professor
everything
during
that I own that he's got a team. Whether we'll ever find that out and he'll say it publicly, I think that's a different question.
Well, he's talked about the BCS. I mean, he's talked pretty candidly about sports. I don't know. Jay, what do you think? What do you think? You think he'll talk?
Jay is our resident sports expert.
Yeah, I think he could. Bulls, you think it's going to be Bulls? Yeah, I think you're right.
You think so?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, even though they're a tough team now.
You can't upset Chicago like that.
That's right. That's right. He's got to go Bulls. Jay's right.
Well, there's an argument.
So on this holiday morning around the world in deployments of all kinds in war zones everywhere in the world, there are thousands and thousands of troops on active duty. And that, of course, includes Iraq and Afghanistan. For British troops, however, in Iraq, it's a farewell Christmas in a deployment that has taken many, many years. But it's expected that British troops will be pulling out of southern Iraq sometime next year, perhaps as early as March. Caroline Wyatt is a BBC correspondent in Basra, the city in southern Iraq where British troops have spent most of their time in that nation. We spoke with Caroline earlier and asked her about the troops' anticipation for their impending return home.
I think there is a huge feeling of relief. I've just nipped out of the Christmas dinner that we've been having with men from Five Rifles. This, for some of them, has been their fourth tour of Iraq. I was talking to one man whose newborn son, just 9 days old, he hasn't even seen a photo of him yet. And I said, how do you feel about leaving Iraq now? And he said, we are all relieved that it's coming towards an end. A lot of them do feel that there has been a good job done. They've done what they could, but that after what will be 6 years by the time they leave next March, April, May, all of the troops out by next July, that job will be over. And it's interesting here at the base, I've never seen this before, but there are American troops coming in. So the handover, when it takes place around the end of spring next year, that will be to US troops. And we went out this morning with one US colonel who was with his British comrades, and they went out to a forward operating base, bringing the men a British tradition of rum and tea to wake them up on Christmas morning, a tradition known as gunfire. And there's a lot of camaraderie going on between these. It tastes disgusting. I tried some while I was out. It does wake you up, but it is pretty hideous. And the guys actually, behind the back of their commanding officers, said, you know, we'd rather they just brought us a cold beer, but it's dry. That's their only bit of alcohol for the 6 months they're out here.
Well, you mentioned the four deployments on some of the soldiers that you talked to. You also found a soldier whose deployment is just sort of beginning, and I guess even though it's going to end next year, this is her first Christmas away from home. Listen to this for a moment and then give us a sense of this female soldier.
Is this your first Christmas away from home?
Yes, it is.
How are your family taking that?
Not brilliantly. My parents didn't want to do a family Christmas because they felt that without me there it would be a bit weird, so, but they've got nothing to worry about. I'll be fine and having fun, so they should do the same.
I mean, she's right about that. Basra has been pretty peaceful throughout the deployment. Her family does have very little to worry about, wouldn't you say?
That's right. That was Lieutenant Caroline Cox. She's an education officer with Five Rifles, and she seemed pretty much in good spirits here. And it is true, even out at the forward operating bases, people aren't being shot at on Christmas Day. In fact, we went out into Basra City yesterday and the day before, and we saw British troops chatting very happily with local people. Business is looking up. The economy is looking up. A lot of people within Basra will say that is thanks to the Iraqi army. That is thanks to Iraqi forces being sent in by the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. But those forces have been very much trained and mentored by both British troops down here in the south and very much by American troops. So I think that kind of peace and security returning to the south, at least, is a real credit to both those forces.
So, Caroline, then is there a sense among British troops that their mission was accomplished, or is there any sense of regret for what hasn't been accomplished?
I think many people will have regrets about a lot of the things that happened along the way. This has been a very brutal 5 years for the Iraqi people since the invasion. Hugely high hopes at the beginning, especially here in the south. I remember being here during the invasion, and people down in the south saw it very much as a liberation. But then things happened. Militias infiltrated, people were at war with one another, and there has been a lot of death, a lot of fighting, and a lot of blood spilt also on the side of US troops and British troops down here. So I think many regrets for the way that things went wrong, but relief that at last across the country, but especially down here in the south, things finally seem to be coming good.
Caroline, you know, there's a way of really stepping back and looking at this Basra deployment in a very big historical context. I mean, I'm wondering if there are some members of the British military there who view this deployment as relatively limited as it has been, as you say, as unfulfilling as it has been, as an attempt on the part of the British military to get Iraq right. The history of Britain in Iraq in the 1920s is not a good one. Is there a sense that this time around things went significantly better?
I'm not sure there is this sense, and I think that a lot of the time memories are quite short. Remember that a lot of the men out here are 19, 20, 21 years old. Yes, they've had their briefings, they've talked to Iraqi people. Iraqi people are very well aware of that bit of British history and of Britain's not always successful role in this particular region. I think for most people here, they've been looking at it within the context of the last 5 years, also looking at it within the context of Afghanistan, which is very much at the forefront of people's minds, that as one mission is ending, as they see it at least partially successfully, there is another one that at the moment is not going right. And British forces, as you say, it's been a relatively small deployment, but it has stretched them to the limit. And I think that is another reason for the relief. If this one ends, it does enable British forces to do more in Afghanistan in a campaign where coalition forces and NATO desperately wants to succeed.
Well, Caroline Wyatt, when you finally make it back to the UK, safe travels.
Thank you very much. Not long now.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas. Caroline Wyatt, BBC correspondent from Basra, Iraq. And now headlines from Femi OK.
And just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Isaac Robert Tusi is no longer pardoned. The Brooklyn fraud convict got one of several pardons given out by the president on Tuesday, but by today, it's been rescinded. The White House took the action after learning from news reports that Tusi's father donated tens of thousands of dollars to the Republican Party in April. At least two people are dead and more than a dozen wounded after a car bomb devastated Baghdad. The car blew up outside a restaurant commonly used by police officers in a Shiite neighborhood. Some positive news from Iraq as well. For the first time, Christmas is an official holiday in Iraq. A senior Shiite cleric even attended Mass in Baghdad as a gesture of cooperation with Christians, who make up a very small minority in the country. The death toll has reached at least 19 in Ukraine, where an explosion tore through a five-story apartment building last night. Hundreds of rescuers are digging through the rubble, trying to find survivors among the buried, among the dozens who are still buried, and authorities are blaming a gas leak for the accident. And there's plenty of goodwill coming from the U.S. Postal Service today. Sue Brennan says that her staff will be working hard to make sure customers have a happy holiday.
We will be delivering express mail, priority mail, fruit, and anything that remotely looks like presents.
And some of the postal workers will be dressed up. And FedEx says that all of their offices and domestic sorting stations will be open this morning until noon Eastern time for package pickup. That's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. You may not know the name Virginia O'Hanlon, but you probably heard the story. 101 years ago, she wrote a letter to the newspaper that back then was called the New York Sun. And the letter began, "Dear Editor,
I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus?"
The editor promptly wrote back 6 words.
"Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus."
This is a simple story about a child who wanted to believe, an adult who she forced to think about why it was good to believe. 8-year-old Virginia was living on New York City's Upper West Side when her classmates tried to convince her that Santa was only a myth. In 1974, that debate was immortalized in a film. Here's one of her friends, Billy, making his pitch.
"You don't believe in Santa Claus anymore, do you? That's kid stuff."
"Says who?"
"Says my brother Jim, that's who."
"Oh, what does he know?"
"He knows there's no Santa Claus, that's what."
"Oh, yeah? How can he be so sure?"
"Because because he's practically grown up. And the more grown up you are, the less things there are to believe in.
Virginia didn't buy his argument, and neither did New York Sun editorial writer Francis Church, who refused to accept that as people grow older, they embrace fewer ideas.
Your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds.
With their little minds. But Virginia's letter and the editor's thoughts, even 40 years after she wrote the letter in 1897, Virginia Hanlon, then Mrs. Douglas, was asked about the exchange on WNYC New York Public Radio.
We'd like to know your own reactions when your letter and the answering editorial appeared in the paper in 1897.
I took the editorial very literally, but found it overwhelmingly convincing.
It was a time when newspapers could right no wrong. Mrs. Douglas went on to become a teacher and then a principal. And while teachers of today debate about evolution and creationism, there was no debate in her class about Santa.
By the way, in school, do you teach to believe in Santa Claus?
Oh, yes, we try to.
In 2008, the New York Sun newspaper no longer exists, but it's Virginia's quest to learn the truth about Santa lives on. Though today it's not in newspapers or conversation in living rooms, it's broadcasted in homes by advertisers like Macy's. And the messengers are not children, they're celebrities like Jessica Simpson and Donald Trump.
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
He exists just as love and generosity exist.
How dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus?
There would be no childlike faith.
And it's no also poetry. Referenced in songs, yes, like Mrs. O by the Dresden Dolls. Mrs. O, will you teach us how to keep from getting cold? Virginia Douglas passed away in 1971, but she embraced Santa until the end.
Do you still believe in Santa Claus?
I've had much reason to.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning and Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, Femi, okay?
Thank you very much, Adora Udoji. 13 minutes to the top of the hour. The Christmas day is proving frustrating for many travellers. Miserable weather has slowed down or stopped transit on road, rail and by air. A lot of travellers are waking up in an airport terminal. The governor of Washington declared a winter storm emergency in her state and Seattle expects more snow today. Pirates don't take Christmas off and unfortunately, neither do those fighting them. A German military chopper foiled a pirate attack off the coast of Somalia this morning. Pirates fired on a cargo ship, hurting a crew member. There are now more than a dozen warships hunting pirates in the region. Hijackers have drawn some $30 million in ransom this year. President Bush spends today at Camp David, and this will be his 12th Christmas there. He's been there every year of his presidency, as well as his father's administration. The first family will spend New Year's Eve at their Crawford, Texas ranch. As for the next White House occupant, it's a Hawaii holiday. President-elect Barack Obama is there with family and friends for a 12-day visit. Dinner will be a traditional turkey and ham. And sports fans get their NFL football on Thanksgiving. Christmas Day, it's the NBA. They take center stage. Among the games, the LA Lakers take on the Boston Celtics. Boston coach Doc Rivers says despite the holiday, it's just another game.
You don't get anything after the game. You do. You probably get something from the NBA, like a pin for playing on Christmas.
And if the Celtics win, it will be their 20th victory in a row, which kind of beats a pin.
I think you're right about that.
That's your news for now.
I'd rather have the win than the pin. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Our next guest is here to share the wild and wonderful world of holiday meals from all over the world. Andrew Zimmern is a food writer, the host of Bizarre Foods on the Travel Channel, and he joins us this morning from Minneapolis. Welcome, Andrew.
Merry Christmas.
Now, you've logged many miles in search of all kinds of foods, but let's concentrate on Christmas foods, and you're going to give us a little preview of what some folks are eating all over the world. And why don't we start with, what are they eating in Africa today?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. One of the things that people fail to remember sometimes when it comes to certain holiday traditions is while there are wintertime holidays at this time of year celebrated all over the world, some continents and land masses have different sort of religious rituals celebrated at different times of the year. And quite frankly, it may not necessarily be Christmas. You know, I'm glad we're starting with Africa because some of the oddest things that I've ever heard of is the South African proclivity for sort of imitating the Australians and throwing something on the barbecue with a lot of roasted vegetables. It seems very straightforward until you realize that it's sort of like a steak and potatoes meal that they enjoy down there. What's happened also is that the American culture machine has sort of invaded elsewhere. So in the RSA, for example, they do the traditional turkey feast with all the trimmings as well. It's sort of a strange mix. You know, most of the places in Africa that I've traveled to have been tribal regions in East Africa. And there, they don't know Christmas from the 4th of July. But suffice to say, when the village gets together, it usually involves a roast goat and some lungfish.
Lungfish, huh?
Yeah. It's a horrific prehistoric animal that lives in the mud, and it eats its own tail in the dry season and makes a cocoon out of its own spittle to survive. And it lives in these sort of, you know, swampy areas that get wet and dry and wet and dry several times a year.
It's just horrific.
So there's not a lot of competition for the lungfish, right? You're always going to have plenty of them, right?
Actually, there is. I mean, you know, and it's so prized that whole tribes will go out and dive into the mud for them. I've been on a lungfish hunt, and let me tell you something, it's not pretty. It's not nearly as appealing to Westerners as, the holiday season in, Scandinavia, for example. I mean, look, in Iceland, they'll eat the fermented ice shark and they'll do the smoke puffin and they'll do all that kind of stuff. You know, in Western Europe, they have a lot of their own sort of funky little trends. But once you get it up into the Scandinavian area of Europe, then you're really talking Christmas because these folks, they feel they own Christmas.
And they, so what's going to be on the table there?
I'll try and keep this somewhat cogent. You know, they love smorgasbord. You know, big meals are big. So whether it's Western Russia, which is sort of right below Scandinavia,
right,
or any of the Scandinavian countries, they'll do something. The Russians call it zakuski. The Scandinavians call it smorgasbord. And they'll have lots and lots and lots of food. And some of the things that are eaten, I mean, Sweden is kind of bizarre. I mean, they love to make these little ham and pancake balls that come right before traditional smorgasbord treats, a lot of pickled herring and smoked fish. And then they'll eat the main meal will be a pot of beans and a roast. And they do most of this on Christmas Eve. Most of it was last night. The Russians, of course, do a very similar thing, but they also have lots of, caviar and smoked fish and blintzes and things like that. The Danes have this traditional rice porridge that they make that's sort of like a warm rice pudding, but they don't eat it for dessert. They eat it as a first course, then everyone has a big shellfish feast. Probably one of the more interesting things is up in Finland. I mean, the Finnish people think that Santa Claus lives in the northern part of Finland, which is just hysterical. I love that they have complete and total ownership of it. And everybody cleans their house and gets ready for the big three holy days of Christmas, which started last night, goes today, and then tomorrow,
right,
which they also call Boxing Day. And they usually start out the meal with the rice porridge and fruit, and they decorate a tree. And the Christmas Peace Declaration is broadcast on the television stations from the city of Turku by the mayor, who's kind of like the king of Christmas in that country. And the traditional Christmas dinner is a lot of casseroles with liver and rutabagas and other root vegetables, and they cook a ham and a turkey, and they have rossoli, which is, the herring, smoked herring salad and with lots of beets in it and stuff like that. But what's really hysterical is that, the Laplanders up there love their Christmas, and they do an entirely crazy thing with lots of salads and peas and cold fish plates and spice breads. They're really big, and they just keep celebrating for days and days and days, including the ritual of heading out to a graveyard and lighting lots of candles. And then all the adults spend time trying to con the children into thinking that they hear reindeer bells and Santa Claus. It's really one of the more charming places to spend Christmas if you ever get a chance to get over there.
So it's just like eating spice bread and convincing kids that you're hearing voices.
In between snacking on, you know, a piece of pickled or smoked herring, which is, you know, as a nice Jewish boy from New York, any country that celebrates with smoked fish is quite delightful. I will say probably one of the more unusual things, and it, you know, I learned it in doing my show, is that oftentimes the stuff that's closest to home is the most surprising. So while you would think that the idea of like tossing raw fish salad in the air and eating dried fermented oysters with some sort of weird Gobi Desert fern the way they do in certain homes in China would be strange. Nothing was more unusual to me, simply because I'd never experienced it before, than celebrating Christmas with the White Earth Band of Ojibwe in northern Minnesota, where they actually traditionally shoot a porcupine out of a tree. In the old days, not with a gun, now with a gun. And they pick the quills, which are used for decorative arts, which you have to do very, very carefully. Then they clean the animal, stuff it with potatoes and carrots and turnips, and roast it forever until it falls apart. There's not a lot of meat on a porcupine, even though they get very, very big. It's just
a
very bony. Yeah, exactly.
Who the hell would know?
And then you and
how
then
does
you
it
have
taste,
to,
though, Andrew?
Porcupine is like a
chicken.
Cross between. Between – no. You know you're eating something funky with that stuff. That whole chicken thing it drives me crazy because everything does have its unique flavor. It's very deep and gamey. It's almost a little greasy like raccoon or bear. And it has sort of a pungent flavor as it goes over the – you know, through the palate. The key to game and not having it taste too raunchy, I've learned in a lot of countries, is trimming most of the fat off the outside of the animal before you cook it. The problem there is then you end up with something that's dry. So you have to sort of use a cooking style that helps put some moisture back in.
And that's why you carry that ketchup bottle in your back pocket, right?
Oh, no. Never. You don't want to interfere with the flavor. It's you have a Hall's, you know, a mentholiptus kind of thing in case you run into something extremely funky that you need to get the flavor out of your mouth.
Well, Andrew, you've given us plenty to think about this morning. It's been a great pleasure having you. Thank you.
Well, it's great. Merry Christmas to everyone. And remember, it doesn't matter what you celebrate or when you celebrate it, as long as you do it with food.
Andrew Zimmern is a food writer and the host of Bizarre Foods on the Travel Channel.
Oh, and I'm chewing on a lungfish right now. So we're sending you back to your childhood, where all the dreams, wishes, and desires live. Was there one wish you had as a child that never came true?
The thing that I always wanted when I was a kid for Christmas was an Action Man, which was the British equivalent of a G.I. Joe. But I was never allowed to have one because my father didn't want one of his sons playing with dolls. You know what? My younger brother, he was allowed an Action Man, and an Action Man with a tank. And guess which one of us is now married with kids?
Thank you for that exploration of the deep recesses of the mind from our Jonathan Dyer, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
By March 1, I think we should be able to make some judgments about how good a job the Obama administration is doing. I don't think that means the economy is going to feel any better by March 1.
That's David Leonhardt. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
Given the choice between the two of you, I'd take the seasick crocodile.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
There, in the pile of manure, is that a pony?
I really wanted a Susie Homemaker oven, but for some reason, all I got was pajamas.
It was Christmas Eve, babe.
Every Christmas, the dreams of little children meet the realities of parental budgets, judgments, and just plain practicality. No, Santa can't send you a jetpack or a real D9 bulldozer.
Somehow I always ended up with Barbies. I have a lot of Barbies. And after you rip one or two heads off Barbies, There's only so much you can do with them. And I still, to this day as an adult, have never had my own set of Legos.
Eternal dreams, lingering disappointments.
The boys of the Amalek baby choir were singing, going by. And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
We got holiday traditions on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 25th. It's Christmas. And what was the one gift you didn't get?
A real fire truck, actually. I wanted a real fire truck.
No imitations.
That's right. That's simple.
A real big
Every
fire
kid wants one.
Got
yeah.
it. Well, totally good morning normal. To you, John, and Merry
good
Christmas.
Good morning. Merry Christmas.
We're going to see what's going on in Iraq right now, where war, of course, does not take a holiday. Plus, a look ahead at the new Congress and a Santa census, a real live census on radio. We'll explain. First, these headlines.
If you're with the ones you love on this holiday morning, consider yourself lucky. There are hundreds of travelers unwrapping vending machine snacks instead of gifts at airports flying around the country. Passengers are stranded in airports as ice and snow has frozen flights. Things are especially bad at Chicago O'Hare, and the governor of Washington declared a winter storm emergency in her state. You may have made your plane, but gifts you sent in the mail may be stuck. The Postal Service says they're working today to try to get as many gifts under the tree as possible.
We will be delivering express mail, priority mail, fruit, and anything that remotely looks like presents.
So if you look like a present, you might get to your destination.
President Bush has apparently made history by revoking a presidential pardon. He apparently pardoned a Brooklyn man who did jail time for fraud tied to a mortgage scheme. After news came out that the convict's father made large and recent donations to Republicans, well, the pardon went away. The White House believes this is the first time a presidential pardon has ever been taken away. President Bush spends today at Camp David. As for President-elect Obama, he called for optimism in a recorded speech.
The lessons that have carried us through are the same lessons that we celebrate every Christmas season, the same lessons that guide us to this very day, that hope endures, and that a new birth of peace is always possible.
President-elect Obama is spending Christmas Day in Hawaii.
Christians around the world celebrate the holiday. There is some unrest in the Palestinian territories in Gaza, and it was a partial day of trading yesterday on Wall Street. The Dow went up about half a percentage point. Today, we're looking back to your childhood dreams, wishes, and desires.
The thing I most wanted was a pony. I asked every single year, and I never got it, and I'm so glad I didn't. So thanks, Mom.
That's right. You ever tried to take care of a pony?
Ooh. More than a notion.
It's bigger than
More
a litter than box, a I'm telling you, man. All right, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org with your Christmas desires, anticipated or disappointments.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. A somber note on this Christmas morning. News just arriving in our studios. The BBC is reporting, and elsewhere it's also being reported that Nobel Prize-winning playwright Harold Pinter has died. The UK playwright, 78 years old, had been ill for some time with liver cancer. Also, in this morning, a reminder of the unrest that continues in Iraq. Iraqi police say a car bomb outside a restaurant in Baghdad killed two people and wounded 13 others. We're joined now by Campbell Roberts, a reporter for The New York Times and the Baghdad Bureau, who we spoke with before the reports of the bombing, to get a sense of Christmas in Baghdad, where there may be a Christmas holiday, but there's certainly no let-up in the security arrangements and combat readiness there in Baghdad. Campbell Robertson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The first question I want to ask is, this is the first holiday for soldiers in Iraq. Looking at the status of forces agreement, the new status of forces agreement that was finally nailed down by both the U.S. government and the Iraqi parliament and the Iraqi leadership, which apparently, at least on paper, allows for troops to stay in Iraq, you know, after this year, but be out of Iraq by 2011. Are military personnel in Baghdad feeling that they're on a withdrawal wind-down mode here?
You do hear that. I mean, there a lot of the nitty-gritty is still being worked out. I mean, there are discussions on a daily basis over what exactly these terms mean. But when you talk to soldiers who are out every day doing the work, there definitely is a feeling that you know, we're moving to sort of a withdrawal pace here in terms of handing over as much as possible to the Iraqis in so many different ways.
Campbell, so much time and energy right now here in the U.S. is being spent on President-elect Barack Obama, what he's doing, what the expectations are. Are you hearing a lot of discussion among the troops about the incoming president and what they think about it?
Not really. I mean, you know, when you hang out with at least you know, the privates and the sergeants, there's just almost no discussion of politics. I mean, you know, every day, you know, two, three patrols a day, they're mainly concerned with, you know, what's facing them in the day forward and the day next, the day after that. So in a lot of these days, it's sort of they're getting new guidelines almost on a daily basis over, okay, under the sofa, this is what your day's work's going to look like. And then 2 days later, okay, we figured this part out too. So there's a lot for them to be dealing with right now. And, you know, I think this is kind of up in the sky for them in terms of the president-elect and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, there's a tension that comes into play in a combat zone when forces get on a more withdrawal footing in the sense that you don't want to be the, you know, last casualty out of Iraq. How is morale at this point?
It's good. I mean, it's interesting in the sense that, you know, handing it over to these other troops sort of creates all sorts of conflicted feelings. On the one hand, the Iraqi army works in mysterious ways, to quote you too, I guess. And I think a lot of the Americans are sort of coming to terms with how they work because they know they're going to be taken over. And so I think at first, maybe some months ago when I'd hang out with American soldiers, they'd say, this is a very strange and haphazard way of going about things. But I think a lot of them are beginning to understand that the way the Iraqis do it may not look like it makes sense to Americans, but actually may be the most efficient way to do things around here. So I think there is sort of a growing appreciation among some of the guys I've talked to, at least, that, you know, the Iraqis, they may look a little nuts sometimes the way they do things, but this actually may be the best way to do things.
Well, that's interesting. Let's explore that a little bit. I mean, within the last couple of months, the Iraqis took over the arrangement with the Awakening up in Anbar province and the Fallujah area, which was the center of the surge where David Petraeus had so much success, actually paying tribal leaders up in that area. How has that gone, and how is that a model for other sorts of responsibilities being taken over by Iraqi forces as we move ahead?
Well, it's interesting. Well, I was talking about this today with a colleague here. They took over in Baghdad a couple of months ago, and there was a lot of reason for nerves because, you know, the government has expressed numerous times, you know, this is a huge armed Sunni group that has kept his arms and is walking the streets, which doesn't make the largely Shiite government sort of sleep easy at night. So there were worries when the U.S. was transferring over that, you know, a lot of these guys were being arrested, that, you know, the government might try to shut it down. But frankly, in Baghdad, we were driving down the streets today. The Awakening guys were out there being, you know, they've been paid by the Iraqis for a couple of months now. I mean, the U.S. is keeping a very close eye on it, so who knows what happens when we start pulling back in terms of that. But so far in Baghdad, it's gone actually quite smoothly.
So in watching this transition, does this feel like progress for the troops who are working with the Iraqis?
I think it's too early to say what's going to happen. But, you know, you find some optimism, at least among some officers I talk to, that we're moving from state of emergency to a civil state. I mean, it's still very sloppy and there's still a lot of holes, but, you know, there is some optimism on troops that this, some of this is actually surprisingly working quite well under the Iraqis.
So let's take a look from the perspective of a reporter. I know that every time you go back to Baghdad, it's a sort of a different set of arrangements in terms of your ability to interact with Iraqis, to get in and out of the green zone, to maintain a sense of autonomy on the streets of Iraq or even out in the, some of the provinces. But if you interact with Iraqis and maybe even relying on your network of stringers there at the New York Times, do Iraqis have a sense now of what the future of their country is going to be like, you know, maybe 5 years down the road?
Iraqis, completely understandably, tend to be a pretty cynical group. I mean, they make New Yorkers look like optimists. So there are a lot of them who feel, there are a lot of Iraqis I talk to who will tell you privately when the U.S. pulls out, this is all going to go south really quickly. But, you know, it's hard to know because I think everybody is sort of on a wait-and-see attitude right now. I mean, and obviously there are other very vocal Iraqis who say the only way to solve this is for the U.S. to get out immediately. So you really get a whole range of opinion.
Well, then I guess perhaps the mission between now and 2011 for U.S. forces is to instill enough confidence in Iraqis so that that cynicism begins to diminish. Do officers think that that's a possibility?
I do, and there are two different brands of cynicism. I mean, within the Army, a lot of Iraqi Army officers are very nervous. They just don't feel, they feel like they're doing well, but they're nowhere near ready. And then out in the street, there's less feeling about that and more just a cynicism about politicians. I mean, you know, one of the first lessons of democracy is cynicism, I suppose, to see politicians disappoint you. So I think a lot of the Iraqis who are not in the military are just very disappointed in their political leaders.
You're full of aphorisms this morning, Campbell. Are you writing a book? Are you one of these
I really am.
Yeah.
I apologize.
No, that's all right. That's okay. What deployment is this for you? Or not deployment, but what? How many visits have you made to Baghdad?
I'm coming to the end of my second rotation. I was there for about 2.5 months this summer, and then I came in early November.
Is it very different now?
Not really. I mean, there's, you know, the security agreement has been a big focus, and now everyone's sort of looking at the provincial elections in a month, and that's kind of what everybody's talking about right now.
Well, that's the next event on the calendar. Merry Christmas to you, Campbell Robertson.
Thank you, and you too.
Campbell Robertson, a reporter for the New York Times, part of the Baghdad Bureau, joined us from Baghdad. And news that we've learned about within the hour from London, Harold Pinter, a very severe critic of the Iraq War, Nobel Prize-winning playwright, actor, and author, died last night. He was 78. He's known for plays such as The Caretaker, The Birthday Party, The Dumbwaiter. The Caretaker, of course, was the play that brought him to fame in 1960. As a critic of the Iraq War, though, the London Daily Mail this morning reports that he called George Bush at one point a mass murderer and was a robust critic of Tony Blair. Harold Pinter, the playwright, died at age 78, Nobel Prize winner. And we are taking you back to childhood, under the tree, reality meets the dreams of children at Christmas. What you dreamed of may or may not show up under the Christmas tree. And we want to know your stories of that time. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Kind of a look back on this Christmas morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Here at The Takeaway, when it comes to politics, we don't have a crystal ball, but what we do have is blogger Nate Silver. And you may recall he is the founder of 538.com, where during this past political season, his website became the go-to spot for obsessive poll watchers during the elections. He was using his skills as a baseball statistician to do things like call the president's race for Obama, and he did that back in March. Now he's turned his attention to Congress and what numbers there can foretell about what's going to happen in 2009. He joins us. Welcome, Nate.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you have a couple of predictions. Let's start with the Senate, and you've taken a look at what Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has done this year. What do you think it says about next year?
Well, it's going to be different, I think. I think, you know, governing when you don't really control the agenda because you don't have the White House is a different thing than when you do, and when Obama might have, you know, a half dozen key agenda items he wants to get done in the first 6 to 9 months. So it'll be an adjustment. I think they have to play a bit more offense. I think they're used to playing defense even when they had the majority. And so we'll see if kind of Harry Reid is up to the task to facilitating what Obama wants to do.
You've called him ineffective as majority leader. Can you explain that?
Well, one thing we looked at is the number of filibusters, really the number of cloture votes. This is a motion to end debate and proceed to actually have an up or down vote. There were twice as many of those votes last year in the 110th Congress as there have been in a long time, twice as many as there were 2 years prior, for example. It doesn't necessarily mean he's ineffective, but that was my take on it, given that usually you want to extract some public pressure on the other side, so if they are obstructing legislation, people know about it, or you're kind of giving them some carrots or some sticks, so you're compromising in some way. You know, the Congress got very little done last year in general. I would say the kind of culture of the Senate is maybe not as strong as and as bipartisan as it might have been in times past, and as a result, kind of no one wound up being happy.
Well, in the Lyndon Johnson era of the Senate, you had a lot more going on behind the scenes, it seemed to me, and so it would never come to a cloture vote because things were already sort of figured out. It's as though Harry Reid has just accepted the cloture vote as an arbiter here, and so that's why there's so many, and he doesn't have 60 votes, so he loses a lot.
Yeah, I mean, one argument I've been making, too, is that maybe he's almost too quick to use that cloture option. Instead of, you know, maybe you should string the Republicans out a little bit longer, force them to actually use the delay tactics on the floor and create a bit more of a kind of public spectacle. But we clearly are a long way away from the LBJ era. I mean, for one thing, both parties have gotten more polarized. The Democrats tend to be more liberal than they were, and Republicans more conservative. So it's kind of harder to find that middle ground. You don't kind of have these Southern Democrats like you used to, where it was kind of a de facto third party almost. But nevertheless, there's not so much cooperation, and I think people are always worried about things blowing up at any time. There's a lot of bad blood on both sides. You know, with the whole kind of nuclear option debate, I think, a couple of years ago, that also kind of put everyone's on kind of on the brink, really, of kind of blowing up at any time.
Explain to us how you're taking a look at the numbers and coming up with conclusions on how Congress is going to be working.
Well, one thing we want to look at is kind of where are people under pressure electorally, because I think congressional behavior is pretty predictable, really. You know, if you look at the bailout vote, for example, both the auto bailout and the bailout back in the summer, you know, for the financial bailout, people kind of in higher income districts were more inclined to support it, certainly, where you have more kind of an investor class of voter. People who were up for re-election were less inclined to support it. So that's kind of what we're looking at, is really is kind of demystifying all the behavior of Congress, because really, you know, these people have incentives. The biggest incentive most any congressman has is, number one, getting re-elected, but also kind of not getting yelled at. It's a question of, do I anger my constituents, the people who are giving me money, by doing this for my kind of fellow Democrats or fellow Republicans who are trying to kind of show how the sausage is made, so to speak.
And you're presuming that initially, at least, when the Congress sets out, that much of what the individual lawmakers decide to do is going to be tied to how popular Obama was in their state. Explain that.
Well, I think so. If we looked at the auto bailout bill, for example, there were 10 Republicans who voted actually for cloture on that bill. And they were, you know, I think 8 out of the 10 were from states that Obama won, states like Maine, which he won by 17 or 18 points, or Pennsylvania, or Ohio. You know, conversely, the 3 or 4 Democrats who voted against it were from red states that he had lost, states like Arkansas, Louisiana, where you have Democratic senators, but where Obama's not very popular. I mean, right now, Obama is the star of the show. As pessimistic as the country is right now, he should have 70% or so approval ratings beginning his term, which is the highest of any president starting his term since John F. Kennedy. as long as he's that popular, then people, you know, in states that he won by a large margin can't really afford to obstruct his agenda. But conversely, the minute he runs into problems they could snowball, where you do have, you know, say Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, a state he lost badly, who's up for re-election in 2010, she'll be looking maybe to defy him if he's no longer so popular nationally.
And that already succeeded in Georgia, where Saxby Chambliss already won a runoff election and used that explicitly as the campaign issue.
Yeah, I think the public's feeling is that, you know, we've given Obama and the Democrats enough ammunition, you know, whether they have 57 or 58 or 59 senators, depending on how Illinois and Minnesota are resolved, and, you know, with a large advantage in the House. You know, I think the public's feeling is, you know, we're not going to take any excuses for them not getting stuff done. I think it would behoove the administration to pursue an active agenda. I think almost trying and failing would almost look better in the public eye than being overly cautious.
Nate Silver, thank you very much. Nate Silver is a blogger for 538.com. In fact, one of the founders of that website. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got a few headlines for us.
And the time is 27 minutes past the hour. Israel's defense minister warns that Palestinian militants in Gaza will pay a heavy price if rocket attacks continue. This week, rocket and mortar attacks on Israel stepped up. Israeli retaliation could come in the form of airstrikes once the weather clears in Gaza. At least two people are dead and more than a dozen wounded after a car bomb devastated Baghdad. The car blew up outside a restaurant in a Shiite neighborhood this morning. It was a restaurant that's commonly used by Iraqi policemen. A crew narrowly escaped a vicious pirate attack off the coast of Somalia. A German military helicopter stopped the attack, but not before the crew member was hurt. And there are now more than a dozen warships hunting pirates in the region. Hijackers have drawn some $30 million in ransom money this year. Now, we've talked about the bad weather stranding people in airports for the holidays, but presents get stuck as well. And the Postal Service is hard at work today, hoping to get every present under the tree in time.
We will be delivering express mail, priority mail, fruit, and anything that remotely looks like presents.
And some gifts have made it as far as Iraq, and Major General David Perkins says that troops love them.
A package from home with Christmas cookies and things like that means a lot to the servicemen and women here, as well as to their friends who usually get to share in that as well.
And that's a look at your news for now, Adora John.
Thank you, Femi. So, dreams under the tree.
When I was younger, I really wanted the Vision Psycho Sticks skateboard for Christmas. My parents tried hard but didn't know. They got me the Nash skateboard.
Wrong skateboard. Ouch. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So, probably as recently as last year, if you ask people what the biggest threat to the world was, they might not respond collapsing global capitalism. They might be more likely to give you an answer like global warming or climate change or environmental population issues as one of the leading threats to the world. But now the question is, if the economic downturn is going to take center stage as Barack Obama takes office, how is that going to affect the urgency with which scientists and policymakers are approaching global warming, which is certainly still with us? And joining us to talk about this as we look forward to 2009 is David Green, who's a senior researcher at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Knoxville, Tennessee. David, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
And I understand that you're back from the climate change conference that took place in Poland just recently. But I'm just wondering generally, before we talk about the conference, do you think this economic downturn is going to slow down or speed up global urgency and policy devoted to climate change and the environment?
I think that's an interesting question. It remains to be seen. I mean, on the one hand, there's less money for the government to spend. On the other hand, it's urgent that the government spend money to stimulate the economy, and this is certainly something that really they need to do.
Now, in Poland, were people taking a look at what Barack Obama is talking about as far as stimulating the economy by stimulating green infrastructure, green development programs, the production of solar panels, that sort of thing, as a viable option going forward?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of excitement at the COP meeting in Poznan about Obama and the direction he's going to take. And Al Gore spoke to the conference on the last day about that, and it was like a rock star was there. And it was just tremendous enthusiasm about, you know, the U.S. is going to now take a position of leadership in the world on climate change, and I think a tremendous upbeat ending to the conference.
So, David, is the economic crisis then being seen as a potential opportunity?
It could be. I think, you know, I think we have to see how that works out. I mean, in the past, there's been a lot of talk about what could be done in energy, hydrogen vehicles, oil independence, energy independence, that kind of thing, and not really a serious policy effort put together, except after the first oil crisis in the mid-70s.
Well, certainly the storerooms in Washington and all around the United States and the world really are filled with prototypes of things that would be great ideas if they were done on a mass scale. As a scientist, what makes more sense to scale up as a big program to have an impact on the environment? The high-tech kinds of programs, such as hydrogen, which you're talking about there, or low-tech programs like passive solar and other ideas that maybe don't involve a lot of whiz-bang technology, but if applied on a grand scale, could have a massive impact?
I think what you're talking about is low-tech needs to come first. In other words, we need to massively improve energy efficiency. That would be the first thing. We need to actually produce more energy, because we need to solve both this oil dependence problem and the climate change problem at the same time. So we really have to produce more oil, but we need to massively improve the energy efficiency first. Things like plug-in hybrid vehicles may come next, and then after that, perhaps fuel cells or battery electric vehicles. But I really think that's two decades, perhaps, from now.
So is that an argument for nuclear?
Yeah, I think nuclear certainly has a place in a low-carbon world. If we're going to dramatically reduce our carbon emissions, we will want to use nuclear power.
As a scientist, when you evaluate Barack Obama's statement that we should put people to work making solar panels, and these wouldn't be passive solar panels, but photovoltaic solar panels, does that make sense scientifically? Because there are some studies that suggest that the production of solar panels on a mass scale would actually use more energy than would be conserved by applying them to residential and other consumer uses.
Well, I think for some things like solar panels, batteries, these are energy intensive to build. But once you get them in place, you get back the energy savings rather quickly. So I don't think that should stop us from going ahead with that kind of program.
And as you look towards the end of 2009, what do you think, looking back, would be the biggest headline on climate change and the environment? What would, first of all, be a headline you'd love to see, and what do you think you're going to see?
Well, I think what I want to see is the United States take a firm stand and implement a policy that calls for, in the long run, deep reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. So we're talking about looking forward all the way to 2050 and saying we're going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions anywhere from 50 to 80%. That's what the climate scientists think is the range of what we need to do. I think we can make that commitment in 2009 by implementing something like a carbon cap and trade system or a tax on carbon, but to set those targets and say, look, that's where we're going.
And you believe that's scientifically feasible. What about a headline you're likely to see?
Well, I think that's likely, number one. I think we will make that kind of a commitment. I'm a little worried that we will lose sight of our oil dependence problem because the price of oil, of course, has dropped back down
to
low levels. And we seem to be very short-sighted about that problem. I mean, in the past, we got very excited and very interested when prices were high in the 70s and early 80s. And when prices collapsed in 1986, we just lost interest in the problem.
Well, it's
stopped
working
on it.
It's a frightening double whammy, declining fossil fuel prices and also a declining amount of money for investment on some of these other technologies. But we'll have to see how that turns out. David Green, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, you're welcome.
David Green is a senior researcher at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. He joined us from Knoxville, Tennessee. And now Femi Okeh has the headlines.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, the Nobel laureate Harold Pinter has died. Born in the East End of London, Pinter became known around the world as a playwright, director, actor, and political activist. Now, amongst his 29 plays, The Dumb Waiter, The Birthday Party, and The Caretaker, and Pinter also wrote the screenplay for The French Lieutenant's Woman. And Pinter's wife confirmed his death this morning, aged 78, and we will have more on the life of Harold Pinter in just a few minutes. There's news from Guinea this morning, where the country's military took control. Leaders of the military coup ordered ministers of the ousted government and senior military officers to give themselves up or they would be hunted down. Associated Press News is reporting that the military-controlled radio station has carried the broadcast of Guinea's prime minister turning himself in. President Bush is revoking a pardon issued earlier this week. Isaac Robert Tusi, a fraud convict, got one of several pardons, but he lost it after news came out that his father made large and recent donations to the Republican Party. And finally, Batman the movie Dark Knight has opened in Hong Kong, but there won't be an opening on mainland China. The distributors, Warner Brothers, haven't even submitted the film to the Centres for Approval, and it could be this scene.
Can I cut?
That's causing the trouble. It's set in Hong Kong, and Warner Brothers said for cultural sensitivities, it won't be shown in China.
Chinese are the bad guys. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And if you ever attended a Harold Pinter play, you laughed. Sure, you laughed, but with a growing sense of dread and maybe a sense of anxiety and a sense that you didn't really fully know what was going on.
Sorry, I've lost you.
What do you mean?
I lost you.
No, you didn't. I'm right here where I was.
Anyway, where were we?
Sorry?
I mean, apart from all that, how are you, really?
Terribly well.
Well, you certainly sound well.
I am. Apart from, you know.
Yes, I know.
The word Pinter-esque is in the Oxford Dictionary, partly because of scenes like that. That's Harold Pinter's voice in a short sketch, apart from that, on the BBC. Also, Rupert Graves was there. Harold Pinter died today at the age of 78, and joining us now is Ben Brantley, chief theater critic of The New York Times. Ben, this is the loss of a huge figure in English literature, a Nobel Prize winner, but that just begins to tell the story.
I think that's true. He was indeed the last of the titans in modern theater. I can't think of another playwright in the second half of the 20th century other than Samuel Beckett, who was Mr. Pinter's friend and mentor, who really reshaped the theater. And he also belongs to a time, comes out of a time when theater was still important to a lot of people. And as literature, as art, as something to go to, I'm afraid those days are waning. So it's the last of a time in many ways.
David Hare once said, also a playwright, said that Pinter did what Auden said a poet should do. He cleaned the gutters of the English language so that it ever afterwards flowed more easily and more cleanly. What plays do you think make that clear?
Well, The Homecoming in particular, which fortunately had a fine revival on Broadway last year. One of those plays in which everything seems perfectly normal on the one level, sort of your classic dysfunctional family comedy,
right.
And yet as it goes on, things seem more and more sinister, more and more suspicious. I mean, the great thing about Pinter is that I mean, the acid test, I think, for a great playwright is, do you, when you leave the theater, do you find yourself thinking in the rhythms of the playwright? And that's certainly true of Pinter. You can't go out of a Pinter play without feeling that it's infected your bloodstream like a virus, and you find yourself thinking in pauses and wondering why you said what you said immediately after, and suspicious of language itself, the things that are the very thing that's supposed to give form to your thoughts. So he is a very, very potent stylist.
Well, before we go, you know, one of my favorite quotes of Pinter is, apart from the known and the unknown, what else is there? Which seems to me to tell us exactly what was in all those pauses.
Yes, it's true. I mean, I'm not sure that we know what the known is. It sort of seems to keep fragmenting. In a play like Old Times, in which a couple and a friend of the wife consider their shared past, you realize that no one has the same vision of it, and we don't leave with any certainty as to what that shared past is either. It keeps fragmenting on
Indeed.
Us.
Well, Ben Brantley, thanks so much for joining us. He's the chief theater critic of the New York Times, talking about the death of Harold Pinter, 78 years old, whose references are everywhere in the theater.
A matinee, a Pinter play. A matinee, a Pinter play. Perhaps a piece of Mahler's. I'll drink to that. And one for Mahler.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Christmas Day, and Femi Okeh has just joined us to give you the latest headlines of the hour.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. It will be another tough day for travelers, particularly in the Midwest and the West. Washington's governor declared a winter storm emergency in her state. Seattle expects at least 2 more inches of snow, and other parts of the state could get as much as 7 inches. Rescue workers are trying to find survivors after a gas explosion tore apart an apartment building in Ukraine. They believe a gas leak caused the blast. At least 19 are dead and dozens more missing in the rubble. Trapped residents initially made phone calls to rescue teams, but calls have stopped as the hours dragged on. Some 700 rescuers are part of the effort. An unusual and apparently unprecedented move from President Bush. He's revoking a pardon issued earlier this week. A Brooklyn fraud convict got one of the several pardons, but he lost it after news came out that his father made large and recent donations to Republicans. And the White House says that it's probably the first time a presidential pardon has been revoked.
Apparently he's going to be revoking the invasion of Iraq next. No, he's probably not going to be doing that, actually. Sorry. Just a little Christmas.
Christmas spirit
revocation
for you, John.
Humor.
Yes, thank you.
Sorry.
I put that one in my Christmas crack and read that later. President Bush spends today at Camp David, and this will be his 12th Christmas there. He's been there every year of his presidency, as well as his father's administration. The first family will spend New Year's at their Crawford, Texas ranch. And as for the next White House occupant, it's a Hawaiian holiday. President-elect Barack Obama is there with family and friends for a 12-day visit. And the island may be exotic, but dinner will be traditional, turkey and ham. And United States Postal Office and FedEx are open for business today. And this is the first time that FedEx has actually opened on Christmas Day. They have some backlog to catch up on. And that's a look at your Christmas Day headlines for now. Take care.
Thanks very much, Femi. John, let's talk about Santa.
Sure, why not?
How many Santas are there in the U.S.?
There must be just one. I mean, there's only one Santa.
Yeah, that's right. What you think here. Right. We have a friend at the BBC World Service who has discovered that actually in Europe there are many, many, many Santas.
These aren't counterfeit Santas.
No, they're real Santas.
Real Santas.
Real Santas. Matt Thompson just produced a show. It's called Too Many Santas. It's being broadcast over the holidays by our partners at the BBC World Service. And we spoke to him a little bit about what he found, and this is what he told us. Welcome, Matt.
Hello.
So how many Santas are there in Northern Europe?
Well, in Iceland, there's 13 Santas. And in countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland, there are as many Santas as there are households, because every house has their own mini Santa.
But how does that work exactly? So if we all have our own individual Santas, do they just show up on Christmas Day?
Well, actually, they're there all the time, because in Northern Europe, each house has a protecting spirit. In Norway, it's called the Nissa. In Sweden, it's called the Tomte. And this is generally a good spirit, a protecting spirit who lives in the vicinity of the house. It can get grumpy. And during the year, you have to make a small sacrifice to the spirit, and it will look after your interests and bring you luck.
Sounds a little pagan, Matt.
Yeah, medieval.
It has a touch of that about it. And the more you look into the whole Santa thing, well, it gets interesting the way that some of these pagan aspects, you can still see them in, you know, the Santa Claus we might be more familiar with, because children, for instance, will put out a cookie or a carrot for Santa's reindeer. And, you know, that comes out of these much older traditions.
Would that be considered a sacrifice? Or what kind of sacrifices in Northern Europe are you talking about?
Well, in Norway, you just have to put out a bowl of porridge, but it must have a knob of butter on the top.
Or else?
Or else it doesn't count as a sacrifice.
Matt, so if you had a bad year and actually you didn't behave very well, and just the sort of cookie and eggnog for Santa, you feel like maybe that's not enough. Sacrificing a goat might improve things for you on Christmas Day?
As long as it's not a Christmas goat, because in other countries such as Austria, they have this character called the Yule goat who actually brings the presents. But you're in the right neck of the woods there.
That's right.
I mean,
I'm onto something.
Iceland is completely different. We can come on to that in a minute. They've got a whole weird different shtick there.
And so what is their shtick?
These protecting spirits of the households, they were actually traditionally associated with the grave mounds that you get with all human habitation. Now, when the Vikings went over to Iceland, nobody actually lived there before. It was completely empty. So there weren't any graves for tomtes or nisses to be associated with. So they don't really have that tradition at all in Iceland. And instead, they have these characters called the Christmas lads. There's 13 of them, and they're really like tricksters. They come one a day on the days leading up to Christmas Eve. And in Iceland, your main present is not given to you by Santa Claus. It's actually given by your parents. And what the children do with the Christmas lads is they put a shoe on the inside of their windowsill.
Mm-hmm.
And during the night, the Christmas lads come along. Each night has got a different Christmas lad, and you can tell which one it's going to be because it's, you know, in the newspapers, they'll say which Christmas lad has come in that night. And typically you'll get a small present, what we'd call a happy, in the shoe.
Matt, in America, the Christmas lads are the guys that come over the next day and install the big screen TV on the wall. Actually, it's a little bit different. So your daughter is there, right, Matt?
Yeah, Eliza, yeah.
I mean, she's an expert, so let's just ask her. Eliza, how many Santas are there in the world?
Well, to me, there's only one, because that's the only man who gives me presents.
There you go.
And so who would that Santa be?
Well, typically the one who lives in North Pole.
Typically, I see. So that's the one that comes Christmas Eve along with his reindeer, pulled by his reindeer.
Yep.
Now, do you think all these other Santas that your dad is doing these radio programs about work for that main Santa that comes to your house?
No, they're enemies.
Enemies? Now you're talking. Now, here's a new radio program, Matt.
Santa's enemies.
I love it. I love it. Now we're beyond paganism. We're into world domination.
We're into Hollywood.
Fantastic. Eliza, thank you so much for being a part of the program. I think that's terrific. I mean, these traditions are long held, and are, you know, despite your kind of anthropological approach there, Matt, you're not convincing her of anything.
No, well, I mean, the thing about the Christmas lads is they're actually really scary because their mum's a cannibal and eats children. And, you know, I mean,
a cannibal as in something that eats people, like a person who eats another person?
sort of Hannibal Lecter type person. You know, that aspect, you know, when we think of Santa Claus, he's sort of fat, jolly fellow who's sort of completely good. There's no downside to Santa. Whereas in Iceland, it's really much more ambivalent. And, well, there's a whole other aspect to this, which is quite interesting, which is that these sort of ancient traditions and spirits in Scotland and Iceland and places, you traditionally get women associated with the winter spirits. So the mother of the Christmas lads, who's called Grýla, the reason that she's a woman, if you like, is that you get this association with winter, because in winter it's a time when people are in their houses and the women are sort of in a way in control of the houses. In summer, the men go out and do fighting or whatever they're doing.
So there's all kinds of themes and interwoven bits of history and reality and fantasy. Matt Thompson, thank you so much for joining us about your show, Too Many Santas.
Sounds like Mrs. Claus rules there in Iceland. I did not know that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, pleasure.
Matt Thompson is the producer of a radio show called Too Many Santas, and it's being broadcast over the holidays by our partners, the BBC's World Service. And I just have to add, you learn the darndest things here on the Takeaway.
That's right. We're going back to your childhood. That's what we're learning about, taking a journey to your wishes and dreams and desires. Was there one Christmas wish you had as a child that ever came true?
One Christmas, I asked for bongo drums. I pictured beautiful wooden bongo drums, and what appeared under the tree were the cheesiest plastic bongo drums with a decal of Spanish dancers on the front, which today haunts me and defines my relationship with my family.
Yikes.
Is that too much information or not? But it's a heartwarming, great story, just typical of our listeners. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Full coverage of cheesy bongos on this show. And here's your takeaway.
I mean, the acid test, I think, for a great playwright is, do you, when you leave the theater, do you find yourself thinking in the rhythms of the playwright? And that's certainly true of Pinter. You can't go out of a Pinter play without feeling that it's infected your bloodstream like a virus.
That's New York Times' Ben Brantley, chief theater critic, talking about Harold Pinter, who died yesterday. We are always on, of course, and if you missed anything, even on this Christmas day, you can take our podcast to go. You can subscribe right now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. You should go back and listen to the Ben Brantley interview. It was fantastic. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and wishing you a very happy holiday.
On The Takeaway.
You wouldn't mind my red nose?
Not if you don't mind me being a dentist.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.